toward home. Chapter 5. The summer cottage nestled back in a bay in the tall cedars and pines on the east slope of the Big Rock Candy Mountain. The water in front, beyond the strip of gravelly beach, was in the mornings clear emerald, and sometimes at moonset clear gold. Strung out along the shores were the summer homes of the wealthy and comfortable, and of the not-so-wealthy and not-so-comfortable who wished to appear so. A few miles up the road toward the summit was the monument to the Donner Party, symbol of all the agony in the service of dubious causes, archetype of the American saga of rainbow chasing, dream and denouement immortalized in cobble rock and granite, its pioneer woman and unconsciously ironic portrait of endurance and grief. In the cottage, still not finished, its bedrooms only partly partitioned off, its windows still stopped with bent nails, its yard littered with a half-raked-up mess of shavings, nail kegs, ends of 2x4s and chips, Bruce and his mother lived for a while a summer idyll. His mother was proud of the cottage. "Pa built most of it himself," she said. "He had some carpenters put up the studding and the frame, but he sheathed the whole thing, and shingled the roof, and framed the windows and doors, and even made all the inside doors and cupboards in his spare time. He's been working like a horse every minute. Too much. But I think he liked it. Didn't you, Papa?"
"There's still plenty to do," his father said. "You can take off your shirt any time and fall to. Soon as we finish up the inside here, we can start landscaping."
He was heavier than when Bruce had last seen him. His cheeks sagged a little. His mouth was rarely without a cigar in it. His columnar neck had softened and whitened, and he had obviously been cultivating a hearty laugh. His plans for the cottage were grandiose. What they had here was just a beginning. Turned out to be the servants' wing when they got steaming along. This big room here with the fireplace would stay the main living room, but sooner or later they'd build a wing straight off the back and another wing off that to make a sort of enclosed court, pave it with flagstones for outdoor dining, looking out on the lake. The kitchen and storeroom and laundry room could be built off the other way, where the view was blocked by the woods. Then they'd have some guy come up and plow the yard up and dump on loam and sow a lawn and shine the whole grounds up, put in plenty of shrubs and flowers, maybe a little stone terrace, make it the snappiest place on the lake.
"What do you want to do, make a mansion out of it?" Bruce said. "What's the matter with pine needles for a yard?"
"Hell with that," his father said. "This isn't just any old shanty in the woods. This is a house. Once we get the driveway scraped off and graveled, we can live up here most of the winter, put in a wood-burning furnace. If it gets too cold, we can run over to the coast for a couple of months of the year."
"Well," Bruce said, "give me my orders. I haven't done anything with my hands for so long I've forgotten how."
Thereafter, the two of them worked every morning, nailing in window stops, fitting shutters to the outside frames, lining the interior with wallboard. Bruce protested at the wallboard.
"What can you do with it after it's in?" he said. "You can only paint it, and then it'll look like a cheap imitation of a townhouse. Why not leave the studs showing? It looks more like what it is, then."
"You don't know the seat of your pants from 10 cents a week," his father said amiably. "How can you make a room look like anything as long as it's unfinished? You want this place to look like the homestead?"
"That's all right up in the woods."
"Not for me," his father said. "You can build yourself a ratty little shack somewhere if you want. I'm making this one snappy."
"Why not make it really finished, then? Plaster it, put on moldings, cover the floors, lay in parquetry, go in for indirect lighting and picture windows."
His father made a sound of disgust. He wanted a snappy place, not a shack, but he wasn't going to blow his whole roll on it either. He'd use his own labor and wallboard instead of lath and plaster, and he would get, Bruce assured him, exactly what he wanted, a compromise, a half-baked thing. Elsa stayed out of it. She told Bruce that she was saying nothing whatever about how the house should be made, unless Beau asked her. He was having so much fun puttering that she'd rather let him jazz the whole place up than protest. He loved building things. It took his mind off Chet and business. Not that he had many business worries.
The gambling house was coining money, even with expenses over $20,000 a month.
"He's in the money," she said. "That's where he's always wanted to be. Let him play with it any way he wants. It isn't worth an argument. The lake is so lovely, no kind of house can spoil it."
"It's just silly, that's all," Bruce said. "Wallboard isn't necessary at all, but he spends a couple $100 for it that he might have put into something good. Then he has to buy panel strips to cover the cracks. Then he has to buy paint. He just builds up a lot of unnecessary expense. First thing you know, he'll be putting in crystal chandeliers."
His mother smiled. "I wouldn't be surprised. What harm does it do?"
Bruce shrugged and let it go.
But he couldn't keep from arguing again when his father came out from town with a 5-gallon pail of brown paint.
"Good Lord," he said, "what do you want to paint it for? Those shakes will weather the loveliest soft gray in about 2 years."
But within an hour he was swinging a paintbrush, and he swung it rebelliously for the next week, putting 2 coats of oak-leaf brown over the shakes that he would much rather not have touched. He was maliciously pleased at how bad it looked, but his father found nothing wrong with it. He came out, looked it over with approbation, and produced a pail of white for the trim.
"How's your painting arm?" he said.
Bruce shrugged.
"Now that the place is ruined this far, we might as well finish it."
His father shot him a quick, suspicious glare.
"All ruined," he said. "You got a lot of funny ideas in college. Don't colleges believe in paint?"
"Not in the wrong places. But I'll paint it. It needs it now, as far as that goes."
He ducked out of the argument, because every word he said betrayed to the old man the chasm that separated them. It wasn't worth it.
He kept his mouth shut when it came time to mix saffron and green shingle stain for the roof. He didn't even open it to squawk at the line of round niggerhead stones that his father one Sunday laid neatly along the edge of the drive, and he was not at all surprised when his father came out the next morning with a paint bucket and painted them all white.
"Give him another week and he'll be putting blue spots on them," he told his mother. "The more he works on this place, the more it looks like Camp Cozy."
"He's a good carpenter," his mother said,
as if that settled something.
"Sure he's a good carpenter. He's a heck of a good carpenter. He's a cabinet maker. But why doesn't he stick to carpentry or cabinet making, and let somebody whose taste isn't all in his mouth design things? Why does he have to add all these nightmares?"
"He said the stones would outline the drive so people coming in wouldn't run off."
"Who's coming in?" he said. "Once a week, maybe, somebody from Reno. Every other day, a delivery truck. What if they did run off? They've got reverse gears on their cars."
She laughed at him.
"You're butting your head against a wall," she said. "He'll do it the way he wants, no matter what you or anybody else says."
"And we get blamed for his taste. People drive by and look at the place and hold their noses and say, 'Holy cats, look at the monstrosity.'"
"Do you care?"
she said curiously.
"Even if it were as bad as you say, which it isn't, would you care? Does it matter that much to you what people think?"
"I don't know. It just makes me mad, the way he has of putting his fingerprints on everything.
This place ought to be yours and look it, not his."
"Ah, Bruce," she said, "you're hard on your father."
The expression he saw in her face surprised him.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm an intolerant lout. Let's go for a swim."
It wasn't worth an argument. His mother was right, and with the old man gone from noon until almost midnight, they had the place to themselves. They could swim, fish, putt around the lake in the motorboat. The boat had a mast step in it, and in a few afternoons Bruce cobbled a mast out of a cedar pole, got an old sail from a camper down the lake, and improvised a rig. He was no sailor, but it was fun to come ghosting into the bays over the water that shifted cobalt to emerald, and to hear the silence along the forested shore. A motor was all right. It was a lazy man's way to go boating or fishing. He supposed it matched his old man, somehow. But a sail, even a clumsy and inefficient one, was better. A canoe was better. Even a rowboat was better. The more labor-saving the machinery, the less the pleasure. But not for Beau Mason. He believed in modern improvements.
Anything that wasn't the latest was an old granny system. He had even come to the point now where an unpaved road was a personal insult, and a detour a deliberate conspiracy to spoil his day. Considering the roads he had driven on in his time, that was quite a step. His father's was a curious state of mind, Bruce reflected. He and his mother would probably have been content to sit on the pine needles and watch the lake. They would never have finished the cottage inside, or painted it outside, or lined up the driveway, or projected any landscaping. They liked the present. They preferred the static. But for the old man, today was only a time in which to get steamed up about tomorrow. The world went forward as a wheel turns, and if you didn't keep up with it, you were an old fogey. Your bank account got bigger, your needs became more and more elaborate, your appetites required stronger and stronger stimulation, your ideas of what was your just due became more grandiose. Even the gastrointestinal tract, he said, even the amount of laxatives you take to keep your bowels open. Last year one phenemint, this year 2 X-laxes, next year 3 Seidlitz powders. By God, it was laughable. Oh, for the tomorrow when you have graduated to Pluto water. Oh, for the day of the daily enema. Yet he enjoyed those weeks. He liked working with tools. He liked fishing, swimming, sailing. He liked the days when they all went down to Reno. He had fun playing nickels on the chuckaluck cage, methodically playing the odd and doubling when he lost. He took pleasure in the $2 or $3 he won every time he went in, and he even got a certain rueful enjoyment out of the cleaning the game took him for when it finally took him. He played the slot machines and had beers at the bar and watched the crowds mill through the place, jamming up by the crap tables and the Wheel of Fortune and the roulette wheels, thinning out toward the back where the intent games of poker and blackjack and panguini went on, thinning out still more at the very back, where deadpan Chinamen and professional gamblers sat endlessly playing faro. He met dozens of gamblers, shills, bouncers. Prizefighters and movie stars and tourists and shrill women surged through the place night and day. When one of the janitors of the club died of a heart attack in the little back room among his brooms and brushes, his father offered him the job, $12 a day for pushing a broom, 8 hours among the multitudinous feet. He might have taken that job if his mother had not asked him to pass it up. It took only a few visits to the club to understand his father's excitement about the place. There was excitement merely in the stacks of silver dollars on the tables, in the flat chants of the dealers, in the screeches of touring school teachers when they hit the jackpot on a slot machine or won $2 at craps. There was excitement in the 3 or 4 floor managers, his father among them, who went constantly through the crowd, keeping an eye out for pickpockets or slot machine sluggers. The afternoon when a much-advertised fugitive from justice passed a stolen traveler's check at the cashier's window and was picked up at the door by a pair of bouncers, relieved of his shoulder gun, and led off to jail, was a fine and thrilling afternoon. There was something not so thrilling about what was done with the men who were occasionally caught cheating or slugging a machine. Bruce had seen them 2 or 3 times being led quietly downstairs by a pair of husky bouncers, and he had seen the bouncers come back after about 15 minutes and quietly mingle with the crowd again. None of the tin horns ever came up. When he asked his father what went on down there, his father said the bouncers beat hell out of them and tossed them out into Douglas Alley by a back door. He could see how the big money, the quick money, the easy money, could take hold on his father. He did not know how deeply it had taken hold until one afternoon when a photographer and a reporter from a magazine came to shoot and investigate the place. Bruce saw his father shouldering through the crowd with his glad-hand smile, his hearty laugh, escorting the photographer around. He saw him laughing with self-conscious playfulness when the photographer stood him up at the edge of the crowd and took a shot of him, summer jacket, stick pin, smile and all. When the article appeared, only a couple of weeks later, Beau Mason loomed over the crowd, his chin up, his smile gleaming, his hand up in a gesture of greeting or fellowship. The big shot. The instant he saw it, Bruce was reminded of the night he and Chet graduated from high school, and Chet came up to get his football sweater. The same look, the same inability to keep the gratified and self-gratulatory smile off the mouth, the same playing for the gallery. He hated that picture and the things it reminded him of. He didn't want to think of Chet that way. In July, Bruce's mother reminded him that if he wanted to have friends come and stay a while, she would be glad to have them. So he wrote to Joe Mulder in Salt Lake, and later in the month, Joe and his sister came down. Bruce half expected to have his father object to putting them up. It had happened before. What was the idea of asking everybody in the world to come see you, eat up $20 worth of food, burn up a lot of gas, cost you a lot of money, and waste your time? Let them stay at a hotel if they wanted to stop over. But this time his father even seemed to want them. Perhaps being free of the fear of the law let him loosen up. Perhaps he merely was proud of himself and his place and wanted to show off. Anyway, to Bruce's half-cynical surprise, he put himself out. He was jovial at table. He took the visitors for boat rides. He personally escorted them through the club and showed them how to shoot craps. He made booming wisecracks to the dealer so that people looked over at him, and Bruce saw them whisper to each other. Must be the boss. Look at him toss out the bucks there. Big shot, obviously. Joe and his sister were delighted. They whirled through Reno like a pair of sand devils. They loved the gambling. They were tickled by the way you could go up to any cop and ask where the nearest speakeasy was and have him direct you. There was no city or state liquor law, and the city cops didn't have any percentage in enforcing federal laws. They loved the mineral springs where Beau took them all swimming. They were full of admiration for how rich Beau Mason was, and they laughed themselves helpless at his wisecracks. Even Bruce grudgingly admitted that he was really funny when he got wound up. The night after the swimming, Beau was still expansive. He took them out to Steamboat Springs, set them up to dinner, flirted with Helen Mulder and kidded her pink, crooked a lordly finger at the soulful-eyed Mexican with the guitar who was singing sweet, sad, sentimental songs to the diners, and had him over to sing Helen's favorites. For every song he tossed the Mexican a silver dollar, and for an hour afterward, after he had gone to sing, hopefully, at other tables, the Mexican kept looking back at the Mason table, showing his teeth and eyes, flirting at a distance with the girl there, hoping that the big man with the diamond would crook his finger again. That was quite an evening. Beau stooped to dance, a thing he had not done in 25 years, and he cut his shift at the club. For a good many weeks there was nothing wrong with that summer. The jazzy excitement of Reno could be sloughed off in the lake's quiet. The hangover of too many cigarettes and too late hours could be dissipated simply by lying under the pines and watching the shifting color of the lake that Mark Twain called the most beautiful in the world. There were books to read and good long hours of puttering with tools, the hands busy and the mind quiet. The club was still doing well, though the fantastic take of the early summer had fallen off. The prize-fight crowd which had come in to watch the Bayer Uskudun fight, and the Basque sheepherders who had come in droves to bet money on their wood-chopping countrymen against the Livermore butcher boy, had flocked out again. Rings still went into the truckee regularly, and the courthouse pillars still acquired new smears of lipstick from the grateful mouths of pilgrims, and the kids who planted dime-store rings in the river and then fished them out again to sell to gullible tourists still did a fair business. The town was good, but not as good as it had been. Business at the club fell off just enough to make Beau sit down occasionally to his figuring, to make him curse the neon company that charged $1,200 for a sign, to make him chew his lips over the two men who came in one afternoon with plenty of money in their pockets and played dimes on the chuck-a-luck cage. In one afternoon they took $400 out of the game with their little penny ante bets, and it made Beau mad. There were several things like that. The Faro game had a streak of losing, until Beau had half a mind to take Faro out of the club entirely. There wasn't enough percentage in favor of the house. A smart gambler could win at it, and most of the people who played it were professionals as slick as the dealers. Yet in the long run you couldn't afford to close out the Monte games and lose those professionals. Increasingly, Beau left the finishing of the cottage to Bruce, and even when he did work on the place he was likely to be jerky and irritable, to burst into an inordinate flood of swearing if he made a mistake or couldn't get a joint to fit or hurt his hands. He complained of headaches and sleeplessness.
"Why don't you just rest when you come up here?" Elsa said. "You're down there too much, and then you come up here and work instead of resting. Just sit around and take it easy, or go fishing."
"Yeah," he said, "I better do that. No use getting myself run down."
But he couldn't sit still.
The first morning he tried it, he read the paper for an hour and sat for a half hour more on the porch. By 10:30 he was out in the yard making a bench out of two short lengths of log and a wide slab of pine. It would, he said, make a nice place for anyone to sit down under the trees if they wanted to lazy around in the yard. Every night the faro game was in the red when checks were counted after the midnight change of shifts. After a week, following a talk with Laurent, Beau fired one of the dealers, a little cold-eyed man who had been a boxer and hired a dealer newly arrived from one of the gambling boats outside the 12-mile limit off Long Beach. O'Brien, the dismissed dealer, was sore. He called Beau names and got abusive and violent, until Beau had him thrown out of the place by a couple of shills. "The goddamn guy," he said later up at the lake. "He's been losing at that table ever since he went in there. We pay those cookies $20 a day. That ought to be plenty to make them want to work for the house. What does he want, for Christ's sake? I wouldn't be surprised if he'd been chiseling all the time."
"Well, he's fired," Elsa said. "I wouldn't worry about him."
"I'm not worrying about him. The hell with him. I'm worrying about that Monty game. We're making money on everything else. If we made money on that, we'd be in clover. It takes the profits from two crap tables to pay for that damn thing."
"Doesn't it work in streaks?" she said. "Won't it start winning again sometime?"
"That's what I'm talking about," he said. "Sure it will. It's got to. But this streak has gone on for 3 weeks. Can't you understand what I'm telling you?"
"You needn't get mad at me," she said. "I'm not making it lose. I should think if you're going to be a gambler, you'd have to make up your mind to take what the luck brings."
In his glare, there was something like pity for anyone who could make a remark like that. The next afternoon, Bruce was sitting in a bathing suit on the gunwale of the boat, repairing the cobbled rigging, when his mother came down to the shore.
"Can you drive me into town this afternoon?" she said. "I hate to take you away from the lake on such a nice day, but I've got to go in."
"Sure," he said. "Need some groceries?" He was bending down, twisting a wire tight with pliers, and when she didn't answer, he looked up. Her face wore a deprecatory grimace, and her eyes were puckered at the corners.
"I've got to see the doctor," she said.
He laid down the pliers.
"What for?" "I'm sorry," she said, and he saw that she was embarrassed. "I didn't tell you. The lumps have been coming back, and I'm taking X-ray treatments. I'd have gone in with Pa, only he went early, and I'd have had to wait till midnight to get back."
"You needn't worry about that," he said. "I'm not doing anything." He turned to pull the boat further up on the sand. When he stood up and turned, she was still standing there looking at him.
"You should have told me," he said. "How long have you been taking treatments?"
"Since about April." Her eyes puckered still more, and she put her arm around him as they walked up to the cottage.
"I hate to be a worry and a bother and an expense," she said.
"Nuts to that. Do the treatments work?"
"They take the lumps away, all right, but others keep coming, up in my armpit. They're all just in the skin. I go in once a month. I hate it. They cost like anything."
"Forget what they cost. Don't they give you bad effects?"
"They knock me out a little sometimes." She laughed. "I fainted once. Scared your dad half to death."
"I should think." He opened the screen door for her and shook his fist under her nose. "From now on," he said, "don't you hide things like that from me. You need me to keep you looking after yourself." She paused on the steps, her blue, clear eyes searching his. Then she patted his hand lightly.
"Don't you start worrying," she said. "It's just little nodules under the skin."
but when she went into her bedroom to dress before going into town, he sat on the couch and stared into the black, empty fireplace and felt the heavy beating of his own pulse. In the 1 minute when he looked into her eyes by the door, he had seen that she knew she was going to die. Chapter 6 Three people were in the doctor's office. There would be at least a half hour to wait. "There isn't any use your waiting around," Elsa said. "I can sit here and read a magazine, and you can come back in an hour or so." "Well," he said, "I've got a few things to buy." He looked at her uncertainly, thinking that there wasn't much chance to talk to the doctor about her as long as she was here. He could go over to the club and see what the old man knew. "I'll just be a little while," he said. At the club, the crowd was even thicker than usual. He pushed his way through it to the cashier's window, leaned on the ledge to look around. His father was not in sight. The cashier, a young Basque who played football for St. Mary's, raised his eyebrows and lifted his head in recognition. "My dad around anywhere?" Bruce said. "I thought he went home," the cashier said. He shook his head slightly, as if to say, half smiling, "Too bad."
"What for?"
The cashier fished for a cigarette.
"You didn't see it then."
"See what?"
"Come on in,"
the cashier said. He clicked the lock and pushed the door open. Puzzled, Bruce went in and shut the door after him.
"What happened?"
"I thought probably you'd seen it," the cashier said. "Little mix-up. O'Brien came around with a gun and a pair of brass knucks."
"The faro dealer?"
"Was. Your dad canned him. That's what he was mad about. He got a few drinks in him and came over to clean up."
"What did he do?"
The cashier seemed embarrassed.
"Knocked the old man down," he said, "right over in front of the slot machines. Old man wasn't expecting anything. They were just standing there, arguing a little when O'Brien let one fly."
He looked at Bruce sidelong.
"Give them an even break, your old man had bust him in two," he said. "He wasn't expecting anything."
"Don't apologize," Bruce said. "A guy half his size knocked him down."
"Knocked him kicking," the cashier agreed. "Hung a shiner on him big as a plate. Of course, he's younger than the old man and in better shape. A couple shills grabbed O'Brien and took him down cellar, but Pete's a pretty good friend of O'Brien's. I imagine they just opened the door and turned him loose in the alley."
"Yeah," Bruce said. He looked out through the grilled window at the milling people, men with straw hats on the backs of their heads, coats over their arms, dealers in long eye shades, bending, reaching, leaning back to let their mouths go loose on the interminable chants. Right over in front of the slot machines, right in the middle of the crowd, with a couple of hundred people around, the big shot had been knocked silly by a little bantam who came to his shoulder. It was funny. It made him want to laugh right out loud. But he didn't laugh right out loud. He was ashamed and furious, and he hated the apologetic cashier who really wanted to laugh, who was outside it and could laugh, but who didn't quite dare laugh in the face of the boss's son.
"You think he went back up to the lake?"
"I don't know," the cashier said. "He left here with a towel over his eye. I suppose he was going to a dock. If I had that eye, I sure wouldn't be around at work for a day or two."
"I suppose I'd better get on back and see how he's doing," Bruce said. He nodded to the cashier and let himself out.
In the hot, bright street, the traffic was thick. Cars coated with dust from the desert nosed into the curb to let out women in bloomers and wrinkled blouses and men in creased plus fours. But the traffic and the blare of horns and the heat and the hot tourists and the light blazing up from the sidewalk were out beyond Bruce, beyond arm's length, and between them and his eyes was the image he had had ever since he stepped out of the office, the image of his father, summer jacket, stick pin, heavy dark face, big shot air, going down kicking under O'Brien's fist, and the surprised look on his face, the purpling skin, the expression of heavy, struggling impotence and rage and consternation. It was not a pretty image. It made him crawl. In spite of the heat, he walked very fast back to the doctor's office. His mother was not in the waiting room. He peeked through the door and saw her sitting in a muslin gown, one shoulder bare, with her breast pressed against a little window in the wall. She turned her head at his step and smiled at him, making a little face.
"How's it going?" he said.
"All right. I'll be through in about 10 minutes.
I'll wait outside here."
Lips smiling, eyes puckered, she made her deprecatory face again. "I'm a nuisance."
"You're terrible," he said. "I don't see how I stand you."
He went out and sat down, tried to read a magazine, put it down to stare at the white wall. His father's humiliation was as raw in his mind as if he himself had been knocked down. He found himself hating O'Brien. A damn little hard-eyed chiseler, a borderline gangster, a brainless tough guy. Yet the old man had probably earned what he got. He couldn't fire anybody without insulting him. He'd sit at home and worry about the Monty game and work himself into a fury, and probably snoop around when O'Brien was on shift and make his suspicions perfectly plain, and then finally he would take out all his dissatisfaction on O'Brien, make him the goat. You could hardly blame the dealer for getting sore.
"So maybe this is better than bootlegging," he said.
"So this is legal, and no cops knock on your door late at night. But you play around with the same cheap people, the same flashy men with big roles, the same cheap squaws. You get yourself into a situation where somebody swings on you or takes a shot at you in the alley, and when you get up off the floor with your eye pickled and the crowd gaping at you, you haven't even got a sense of outraged virtue to lean on. All you've got is the officious sympathy of flunkies who will dust off your clothes and get a towel for your eye and laugh after you're gone. And you know they're laughing because anybody likes to see a big shot taken for a ride." He got up from the chair and looked in the door again. His mother sat patiently, her forehead against the wall, her mutilated breast exposed to the healing eye of the window.
"God damn," he said miserably.
On the way back to the lake, she lay back in the seat with her eyes closed, her face paper white, and pinheads of perspiration on her upper lip. The smell of ozone clung in her hair. Bruce drove fast, looking at her now and again, afraid that she had fainted, but when he said, "You feel all right, Mom?" she opened her eyes and smiled and said, "Sure, I'm all right. I just feel a little weak, is all."
"You go to bed when we get back and stay there."
Her only reply was a mild, withdrawn smile, as if the effort of moving her lips were almost too great, and in a kind of terror he started up the long, swinging grade. The smell of ozone that clung to her was like the odor of disease, and looking at her he felt that with that mild smile on her face and her eyes closed, she was contemplating the battleground of her own body, warring cells going crazy, multiplying, proliferating, spreading and crowding out the healthy cells, leaving her less and less of herself. A body completely replaced itself in 7 years. But that was done to pattern, according to a plan. This was something else, an insane crowding of formless hostility, a barbarian invasion, blotting out the order and the form and the identity, transforming it into a shapeless thing that was not his mother at all, but an unidentified colony of cells, functionless and organless and hopeless. For one blasted moment, he stared at her in panic, almost expecting her to bulge and puff and swell, lose her features, change into a grotesque horror before his eyes. She sat with closed eyes, her lips together, breathing quickly but softly through her nose. The crow's feet of laughter were not gone, even in repose, from the corners of her eyes. The new LaSalle was in the garage when they pulled up under the pines. The good mountain smell came down across the cove, and the lake wrinkled under the wind. Stepping down to help his mother from the car, Bruce set his foot on one of the white stones with which his father had lined the drive, and he swore under his breath. "Feel all right, or do you want to rest a minute?" he said.
"I'm all right."
She stepped out and stood straight.
"It never lasts very long."
She looked along the curve of bright lake shore where the slant sun glittered off the water and glanced on the red-brown trunks of the trees flanking the house.
"It would be pretty hard not to feel all right up here," she said. "It was hot in town, that was all."
"Bed for you, anyway," he said, and steered her up the steps. He was hoping that the old man would be off in bed or somewhere. But the first thing he saw as they stepped into the living room was his father, sitting in the big chair by the window, a white pad over one eye, and his other eye glaring at them, bloodshot and furious. He said nothing when they came in, but jerked in his chair.
"Beau,"
Elsa said. She broke from Bruce's hand and crossed the room, laid a hand on Beau's head above the bandage. He flinched irritably away.
"What happened?"
she said.
"Isn't it clear enough what happened?" he said. "I got a black eye."
"Oh."
She stood for a moment, steadying herself by a chair back.
"Have you been to a doctor? Have you had it fixed?"
"Did you think I patched this thing on myself?"
"Come on," Bruce said, and took her arm again. "You're feeling pretty rocky yourself. You go and lie down." But she held back.
"Beau," she said, "who?"
He jerked around in the chair again, and his one visible eye glared out the window. His teeth were bitten together, almost chattering. "Here we go," Bruce thought, almost wearily. "He's been humiliated, and now he's mad, and he'll take it out on anybody within reach." He pulled at his mother's arm. "You're supposed to lie down."
"But your dad is hurt," she said. "Let me be a minute."
"Go and lie down," Bruce said, suddenly furious.
His mother looked at him, glanced at Beau, frowned as if a pain had hit her, and went silently into the bedroom. Bruce, turning from watching her go, found his father's bloodshot eye fixed hard on him.
"What in Christ's biting you?" his father said.
"She's sick," Bruce said.
"She just had a treatment, and I thought she was going to faint all the way home. She's in no shape to doctor anybody or even talk to anybody."
His father glared a moment longer, then turned away with a grunt. "If there's anything you need done to your eye," Bruce said, "I'll do it." His father didn't bother to answer. For almost a week, the old man sat around the cottage, reading the papers, figuring, sprawling back in the chair while Elsa fixed poultices for the injured eye. By the third day, the soreness was gone, but the flesh from his cheekbone to his nose was swollen and purple, with a streak of dull yellow along the upper eyelid. Every time he looked in a mirror, he swore, and when he got up on the fourth morning and found that the other eye had developed sympathetic purple and yellow streaks, he was untouchable for hours. He got the idea that sunlight was good for it, and sat in the yard with his face tilted back. But if a delivery truck came into the drive, or walkers passed along the lakefront, he turned his head away, or raised a newspaper in front of his face, or went inside. Bruce was cynically amused. "He looks like one of those obscene colored baboons," he said, "a sensitive baboon who can't stand his own looks."
"That's not a very nice thing to say."
Bruce shrugged.
"You don't feel a bit sorry for him, do you?" she said.
"I guess not." She shook her head, and her voice was almost pleading.
"There's nothing shameful about being knocked down by a person half your age."
"And half your size," he said.
"O'Brien used to be a prize fighter," she said, "and your dad is pretty close to 60 years old. Did you realize that?"
"I can't help it," Bruce said. "If he's 60, he ought to be the sort of person of 60 that you just don't hit in the eye." She shook her head, her mouth sad.
"You're hard. I guess I don't understand how you can be that hard."
He knew he ought to stop. He was hurting her, and he didn't want to. But he kept on anyway. "Maybe I'm getting even," he said. "Maybe I remember once when he broke my collarbone, knocking me over the woodbox, and once when he rubbed my nose in my own mess." She was looking at him, startled, close to tears.
"I knew you remembered that," she said. "You never forget anything, do you? You never make allowances for hot temper or anything?"
"Forget it," Bruce said. "I don't really hold that against him. I just get sick and tired of all his airs and his self-pity."
"Sometime you'll learn," she said.
She turned away and began pushing the carpet sweeper over the rug, talking straight ahead of her, not at him.
Someday you'll learn that you can't have people exactly the way you want them, and that a little understanding is all you need to make most people seem halfway decent. What you don't understand is that your dad is ashamed to death.
What you don't understand, Bruce said, is that I'm ashamed, too.
She turned, and their eyes met for a moment.
Yes, she said finally. Of course. So am I. But I'm more sad than ashamed.
I know your father better than you do, and I know that just one thing, one little disgrace like that, is about all that's needed now to make an old man of him. He isn't young anymore. Everything goes down from here. I don't think it ever occurred to him before that he wasn't just as young and just as strong as he ever was.
What that means, Bruce said, is that he'll come to you all the more to be babied.
He knew he ought to be slapped, but his mother merely looked at him with her eyes clouded. Then she turned again and took up the handle of the cleaner.
I babied you, too, she said. I couldn't have lived with you if I hadn't.
On Sunday, a long convertible pulled up in the drive, and the Frenchman, Laurent, slid his fat stomach from behind the wheel. Bruce, down on the shore, sawing up driftwood, saw him waddle up on the porch and go in, and he deliberately stayed away until Laurent was gone. Then he took the buck saw up to the garage, got a bottle of beer from the icebox, and came through the living room to the front porch with it. His mother and father were talking in the living room.
Yes, his father said, but they've got to honor their notes. If they don't, we can collect from whoever signs them. That part of it's all right.
Wouldn't they think there was something wrong if you both...
We've got the books. We can prove it to them, can't we? We've been making money.
I should be getting dinner, she said, as Bruce went through the front door. You hungry, Bruce?
Not so hungry I can't wait a while. I'll wait out here. From the porch, he watched the lake between sips of beer. A speedboat cut across the cove, leaving an emerald and white wake, and after 3 or 4 minutes the waves began to slap on the beach. It was a good place, a quiet place, a lovely place. But he was already getting a little restless. Doing nothing all summer was a little wearing. He should have got a job. Still, it was the middle of August now. In another month he'd be threading the ford into the sun's eye across the desert.
So you're capable of staying in one place 2 months and a half before you get jumpy, he said.
You're the guy who was looking for a home.
He shifted himself comfortably and let it go.
The hell with a home. You had to get out and do something, not just vegetate and sail and saw wood.
His parents were still talking inside. It was an hour before his mother called him to dinner. The old man, sitting at the dining-room table, had a pencil and paper and was figuring. He figured until he had to move to make way for a plate.
No, he said, I'd be a sucker to get out just when things are rolling smooth.
What's up? Bruce said. Are we planning to move?
Laurent's got an offer for his third interest, his mother said. Some gamblers from Denver want to buy in.
Doesn't he want to sell?
He isn't sure. Pa got talking with him and figured that he might sell if Laurent didn't want to.
I thought the place was making money.
His father's face across the table was heavy and thoughtful. The discolored flesh around his eye made him look as if he were wearing a mask.
I don't know, he said. I'm damned if I do. It's made money so far, but there's no telling what it'll do in winter. It's bound to fall off.
What would you do if you sold?
How do I know? His father said irritably. I could find something, I guess.
Out of the corner of his eye, Bruce caught his mother's glance and bent to his food. Her look and the expression on the old man's face were equally clear. The club was getting him down. He'd been scared of it from the beginning. It was too big a gamble. He wasn't up to gathering the gold off the Big Rock Candy Mountain once he got there. It weighed him down. It worried him. The excitement it gave him was tinged with fear. He was riding a tiger, and he knew he wasn't the man to do it. It was a sure thing the old man wanted, not a gamble. But that, Bruce said to himself, wasn't the biggest reason why the old man was toying with this chance to get out while he was still ahead. As much as anything else, it was that eye.
The humiliation of going back after 10 days of hiding and having the dealers and shills and steady customers look at him sideways. It was the fear he had of coming back a soiled big shot.
"Like Chet," Bruce said. "Just exactly like Chet. He'd blow this money-making club in a minute to save his pride, only he'd never admit why he was doing it. After working up, or down, to something like this all his life, he'd sell out just because a little tin horn hit him in the eye."
"How much has the place made in the last 6 months?" he said.
"It's only been running 4," his father said. "I don't know exactly. We put in $15,000 apiece. These Denver guys are offering 18 for a third interest."
"It's worth more than that. I expect I'm ahead about 8,000 in 4 months if I could sell my third for 20,000.
"Rate of 25,000 a year for each of you," Bruce said. "You can't gripe at that, except when you come to pay your income tax."
His father laughed.
"Income tax," he said.
"Have you ever paid an income tax?"
"No," his father said, "and I don't intend to."
"Someday they'll haul you off to the pen for 3 years.
They got to catch me first," his father said.
Bruce buttered his roll and laid his knife down. "I'll bet there isn't a family like ours in the United States," he said.
"You've never paid an income tax. Did either of you ever vote?"
"I never did," his mother said. "Isn't that awful? I never knew enough about it to make the effort."
"I guess I voted once," Beau said. "Back in Dakota. How long ago? 25 years? Near 30, I guess."
"Ever serve on a jury?"
"No."
"There we are," Bruce said. "Two of us have never voted, and the other one voted once 30 years ago. We never lived in any house in the United States for more than a year at a time. Since I was born, we've lived in 2 nations, 10 states, 50 different houses. Sooner or later, we're going to have to take out naturalization papers."
"And now we might move right out of here," his mother said. "Just about the time we get the cottage finished up. Wouldn't that be typical? Let's not sell this place, Beau, even if you do sell out of the club."
"This is headquarters," Beau said. "I've paid taxes on this already. That ought to make us permanent residents."
"Do you think you will sell out of the club?" Bruce said.
"If I got a good enough offer, I might. I've got a feeling this whole racket is going to be a flash in the pan."
Bruce laughed. "Here we go round the prickly pear," he said.
"What?"
"Nothing." His mother rose to clear the table for dessert, and he saw her wince.
"What's the matter?" he said.
"Oh, my darned hip."
"What's the matter with your hip?"
"I don't know. Rheumatiz, I guess. I must be getting old."
She made her special face and limped like an old crone into the kitchen. Across the table, Bruce's eyes met his father's, and he saw the question there that he knew must be in his own, and the fear. Thereafter, he had 2 things to watch, one working in his father and one in his mother. His father's problem he did not worry about. It made no great difference to him whether the old man sold the club or not, except as it might affect his mother. But his mother's condition was another thing. Once he had noticed that she was hiding a pain, he couldn't seem to look up without catching her wincing or favoring one side, the same right side always. Her appetite was like a bird's, and she got out of breath easily. "Maybe it's the altitude," he said. "Maybe this is too high for you."
"Oh, it isn't anything. I'm getting old and rickety, that's all."
But he watched her, and he saw that now, in the afternoon, she lay down for a rest, something she had never done as far back as he could remember. And when the old man powdered up his discolored cheek and went into town, he heard her ask him to bring out some sleeping pills. The fear that made him sensitive to her least gesture of weariness or pain made him pretend with her. He kidded her about her rheumatiz, told her that all she needed was a little exercise, like a nice dip in the lake. When she took him up, he was horrified and wouldn't let her. The lake was getting too cold. Finally, he compromised on a mild walk, but when they came back, she was out of breath, weak, her mouth set in a hard line. They had walked less than a mile.
"Your hip?" he said.
I guess I'm not much good anymore.
You're going in and see the doctor.
Oh, fiddlesticks, she said. It's nothing but a little stitch. Probably I've got an abscessed tooth or something.
It wouldn't do any harm to find out.
All right, she said. If it will make you feel better, I'll go next time I go in.
She lay down and rested for an hour while he sat in the sun and whittled aimlessly. At 5:30, his father came back.
Well, Bruce said, sell the gold mine?
His father hesitated on the step as if debating whether to sit down and talk or go inside.
I can make a deal, I think, if I want to.
Where's your mother?
Lying down.
Sick?
His father's face turned sideways to look at him with a fixed, almost vacant expression.
Her hip's hurting her.
The old man chewed his lip and took off his hat. His hair, Bruce noticed, was getting thin, and he was almost white above the ears.
What the devil you suppose that is? He said. It just seemed to come on all of a sudden.
I know what I'm scared it is, Bruce said.
His father's eyes wandered away. He tapped his hat against his trouser leg. His lips moved slightly, and he blinked his eyes.
I'm taking her into the doctor tomorrow, Bruce said. There just isn't any point in not finding out.
Yeah, his father said.
He flapped the hat against his leg.
Yeah.
Well,
he went up the steps and into the house. Bruce followed him, almost as if he were guarding his mother, keeping people who were worrying about selling gambling houses from bothering her with their problems. She was still, apparently, lying down. They went together down the little hall between the partitions and looked in the door of her bedroom. She lay face downward on the bed, and as they looked, they could see her body writhe.
"Mom!" Bruce said. He jumped to the bed and knelt, his arm over her shoulder. "Mom, for God's sake!"
Her shoulder stiffened. For a moment she kept her face in the pillow, then she turned it and smiled, and he saw that her cheeks were wet.
"I'm a baby," she said.
Bruce looked at his father, irresolute, at the foot of the bed. The old man wet his lips and came closer.
"Maybe," he said, "maybe you ought to take a couple aspirin."
She smiled again, and as she shifted on the bed, the smile froze whitely against her teeth.
"I've taken 6, she said. "Damn it," Bruce said wildly. "Why didn't you call me?" "I couldn't seem to make much noise."
Without saying goodbye or where he was going, Bruce went out of the bedroom, walking fast, running as he hit the back steps. The Ford was blocked into the garage by the LaSalle, so he took the LaSalle. As he roared out the drive, he saw his father run to the front door to look after him. At the paved highway, he didn't even bother to wonder which way he was going to turn. He just turned. There were cottages, stores, little centers for groceries, and boats and fishing tackle in both directions on that side. He let the LaSalle out and was startled at how fast it leaped under him. How smoothly it ran, with hardly a sound except an eager, low humming. His foot was almost to the floor when he saw the first store, and he rode the brakes through the loose gravel of the turnout. A man came running out of the service station with a pail in his hand, as if he were going to a fire. Bruce leaned out the window and shouted, "Know of a doctor close around here?"
"Might try the CCC camp," the man said. "Know where it is?"
"No."
"Go right on, exactly 7/10 of a mile. I measured it. There's a sign."
He took his foot off the running board, and Bruce slammed the car into second. The gravel spattered. Bruce's hand went onto the horn and stayed there as he swung around a party of girls parked at the roadside with a flat tire. They started to flag him down and stood with upraised arms and opened mouths as he roared by. At exactly 7/10 of a mile, a road wriggled off into the timber, and he tramped on the brakes and careened in. Back in the timber a half mile, he came to 4 long, low barracks, one of them with a flagpole in front. A man in army uniform was sitting at a desk inside.
"Is there a doctor here?" Bruce said.
"Not right now," the officer said. "He went into Carson this afternoon. Ought to be back by now."
"Damn!"
Bruce said. He was panting as if he had run all the way from the cottage.
"You haven't got any morphine or anything here, have you?"
"The doctor'd have to give you that," the officer said.
He rose from behind the desk.
"What's the matter?"
"My mother's in a hell of a pain," Bruce said. He looked at the officer and saw that the officer thought he was out of his head. It wasn't worth explaining.
"Could you ask the doctor to come over when he gets back, if he comes in the next hour?"
The officer nodded, then lifted his hand and made a motion of shooting a revolver at the door.
"Here he is now," he said.
Bruce was at the car door before it could open.
"Can you come over and look at my mother?" he said. "She's had cancer, carcinoma, had an operation for it. Now she's got awful pains in her hip. I don't know what they are. She's been taking X-ray treatments."
"Wait a minute," the doctor said. He was in army uniform, like the man in the headquarters building. "I'll get my bag." He stepped out and walked with what seemed callous slowness into the building. In 5 minutes he came out, closing his black bag.
"You lead," he said. "I'll follow along."
"I can take you and bring you back."
"No thanks. I'll drive my own."
To the officer standing before the building, he said, "Tell that lousy cook to keep my dinner warm, Harry." She was still in pain when they got back. Beau Mason sat at the head of the bed, holding her hand, looking helpless and clumsy. He got up when the doctor came in and stumbled against the chair. The doctor set his bag where Beau had been.
"Hello," he said to the woman on the bed. "Having a little pain, eh?"
To Bruce, he said, "Can you put a tablespoon in a pan of water and boil it a couple minutes?" Bruce went out, and his father followed him.
"Where'd you find him?" he said.
"CCC camp."
"Couldn't you get anybody better than that? He's probably some horse doctor."
"I don't give a damn," Bruce said. "He can give her a shot of something. I was just looking for somebody quick, and he was the quickest." He filled a pan with water and threw a spoon into it. Leaving it on the burner, he went back into the bedroom. The doctor had his mother bare to the waist and was pressing with his fingertips under her arm, feeling down the scarred side over the bulge of her hip bone. Bruce turned away, but when the doctor had covered her again, without comment, and gone into the kitchen to sterilize a needle, and came back with a hypodermic full of brownish liquid, he watched, because that was what he had got the doctor for. The needle stabbed in. A slight bump of liquid swelled under the skin.
"That will fix you for a while," the doctor said. "You'll sleep a good while, probably. Then you'd better go in and see somebody in town."
She nodded.
"If she wakes up," the doctor said to Bruce, "give her some orange juice or broth or milk, anything. If she doesn't wake up for a long time, don't worry."
He pulled the quilt across her.
"I wouldn't even bother to undress," he said. "You're getting sleepy already."
"I can feel it in my tongue."
"You'll feel it all over in a minute," he said.
He went out and held the door open for Bruce and his father, shut it quietly.
"How long since her operation?"
"A year and a half," Bruce said.
"What is it?" Beau Mason said. "What could be giving her pains like that way down in her hip? She's awful hard to hurt. I never saw her cry for pain in my life before."
His voice was almost babbling. The skin of his face was slack. The doctor shrugged and shook his head.
"You'd better get her into a specialist," he said. "I wouldn't want to say, but my guess would be that it's a secondary growth. When that stuff gets so far along, it breaks off and the bloodstream carries it around."
"You say she's been short of breath?"
"For the last month or so," Bruce said.
"Sounds like lungs, too. Probably she'll have to be tapped."
"Has she got a chance?" Beau said.
The doctor looked at him a moment.
"I doubt it," he said.
She slept until past noon the next day, and when she finally awoke, fuzzy-tongued and drowsy-eyed, she had apparently been dreaming. Her mouth was drooping and sad. That evening she asked Beau if they could go back to Salt Lake.
"Salt Lake," he said. "What for?"
"I want to," she said.
"I don't know why you'd want to go back to that smoky hole for the winter when we could go to L.A. or somewhere."
"Beau," she said, "couldn't we? Even if you don't sell your share in the club, couldn't we?"
She took his hand and held it, watching his face.
"That's where Chet is," she said.
And Bruce saw that it shamed her to have to tell him. She was going to die, and they all knew it.
The next morning, his face gray and haggard, Beau went down and, without a word to anyone, closed the deal for his share of the club. Bruce closed up the cottage by himself, refusing to let his mother get up. His father had gone down to the coast, vaguely on business, and would meet them in Salt Lake. It was clear enough what he was going for. With the club sold,